chapter 6 for me, please. These challenges. For my reading this morning, I want to read the whole of 2 Samuel chapter 6, and it's 20-something verses, so I thought if I put it up there, but I made the mistake of not asking Roger beforehand to get it up. So just keep talking among yourselves until, you know, we get it.
Not the first verse.
Wow, yeah, that's good.
The down arrow will move down the verses.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. 2 Samuel chapter 6. David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Baalah of Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart. And the Ark of God was on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with songs, with harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzziah reached out and took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said to "How can the Ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. The Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Now David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark of God." So David went down and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord were taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord and all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and sound of trumpets. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. In our Bible studies, we're looking at the book of Acts, and as we were considering the situation of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts 5:1, I was reminded of this episode of King David. I believe that apart from Jesus, David is the most written about and most important character in the Bible. I think most of us like the stories about David because he was such a glorious human person. He lived life at full throttle. He worked hard, he played hard, he worshipped hard, and he sinned hard. Irenaeus, a 2nd century church father, said, "The glory of God is a human fully alive." And that was David. When we look upon this episode in his life, we find that the story of David is the most complex, complete, full-blooded, detailed telling of this God-intoxicated humanity that we have anywhere in the Bible. Here is a portrait of a real human being who is deeply in an authentic, no-holds-barred life-and-death relationship with God. And yet for all that, David falls short. He's the best that we can do. He's one of the most alive human beings that ever lived. But even his life sometimes falls apart, physically and emotionally, just like ours. But it's right here that we hear the good news. God, in his grace, takes the best that we can do and makes something of it. Yes. Some years, many years after the time of David, in that same town of Bethlehem, where Samuel first laid eyes on the shepherd boy and poured oil over his head, a baby was born. He was the son of David, the son of God. God takes the raw material of David's brilliant and flawed humanity, which is our humanity, and he blends it in Mary's womb with his own divine son to create a new humanity. He is the root and the offspring of David, the bright morning star of hope for a shining new humanity that's robust, passionate, and alive to God. So where are we in David's story this morning? For years, David had been a fugitive from Saul, but that was all over now. Saul is dead, David is king, but there's some unfinished business, the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark was a rectangular box, just over 4 feet long by 2 feet wide by 2 feet high, and it's made of wood and covered all over with gold. It had enormous significance for Israel. It was normally placed in the Holy of Holies at the very centre of the tabernacle. Above it, between the cherubim, those angel-like figures framing the space around the mercy seat, was a symbolic place of God's presence. Inside the ark were some manna, Aaron's rod, and the stone tablets of the law of Moses. The ark was a kind of sacramental sign of God's active presence with his people. 30 years earlier, before David's time, the ark was lost to the Philistines in battle. But the Philistines suffered all kinds of sickness, and so it was returned to Israel and ended up at the house of Abinadab the priest, where it remained for many years. And it appears that no one was willing to deal with this potent religious object. That is, until now. David decided to move the ark to Jerusalem, his new capital. And as the next chapter shows, he also intended to build a permanent temple for the ark to replace the old tabernacle, now most likely lost and in tatters. And it's certainly an act of spiritual devotion. It's David's uninhibited worship. But it's also an act of shrewd politics. The ark revived potent memories of Israel's beginnings in the wilderness, and its presence in Jerusalem would consolidate David's rule in conjunction with God's rule. The ark brought God and the state into a close and formidable alliance, an alliance that always proved to be full of both possibilities and dangers. So David went up to the house of Abinadab to get the ark. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, loaded the ark on a new ox cart. David led the marching band of lyres, harps, tambourines, and castanets, and with much singing and dancing, the joyful procession set off for Jerusalem. And then it happened. The ox cart lurched in a rut, or possibly over a rock, and Uzzah instinctively reached out to steady it, and he dropped dead on the spot. Talk about raining on the parade. David and all the people were ready for a grand festival of faith, and it suddenly turned into a wake. It's like somebody dying of a heart attack in the middle of the Easter morning service. The worship quickly dies. And I love the next line of the story. David was angry because of the Lord had burst forth with an outburst upon Uzzah. I like that line because it's so human. It's so like David. It's exactly what we feel when we hear the story. Come on, Lord. Is this really necessary? I mean, the man was only trying to save the ark from breaking apart on the ground. Do you have to ruin the party? Do you have to spoil the service? Why? Why did Uzzah have to die? Why, as the text bluntly states, did God strike him down? We don't like that kind of God. Where's the God of long-suffering and loving-kindness so celebrated in the Psalms? And strangely, there's not a word of explanation in the text. The storyteller feels under no obligation to explain God's actions. We're not likely to ever find a totally satisfying explanation of this bizarre episode. But when the storyteller leaves a huge gap like this in the story, there's a kind of implicit invitation for us to try and fill it with our own sanctified insight and imagination. There's some facts that bear on this situation. One is that the law of Moses laid down strict rules for how the ark was to be moved, and there was nothing about ox carts. It was not to be touched by human hands, not carried by Levites with poles, but carried by Levites with poles slipped through rings on the side of the ark, and presumably Abinadab and his sons knew this. But instead, Uzzah and his brothers were intent on using a cart. One insight into Uzzah's death that has consistently appeared over the centuries is that Uzzah is a dramatic example of a person who had God in a box and officially assumes responsibility for keeping God safe. But God can take care of himself, thank you very much. He's not a God that we can carry around on an ox cart, who has to be protected from the bumps and dirts of human life. The scripture shows that, and others like Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament, as a warning of us to beware of God. It's easy to think we have God in a box, ringed by our rituals and hemmed in with our hymns and choruses. We come to worship as though we were coming to afternoon tea with the benign old aunt, all warm and cosy and doing the poor old dear a favour. One thing that you're not likely to find in most churches today is much sense of awe or sense of mystery. I don't pretend to understand this story of Uzzah, and I can easily share David's anger over it. But if it means anything, it must caution us against presuming we know all about God, or we can use God for our own purpose. That's what Uzzah, and even David in his own way, were trying to do. David had a really close relationship with God, but his mistake was to take that relationship for granted. He had a good idea to bring the ark to Jerusalem, but he forgot to consult God about how it should be done. God is a holy God, and that means, among other things, that God is far more loving than we imagine, and far more dangerous than we presume. Now, it's a matter of great amusement to my sons, especially my sons, that whenever I buy anything or given anything new, the first thing that I do after I've opened it is to read the instructions. My kids can't understand why I bother reading the instructions, but I always read the instructions. And generally, I can work whatever we get eventually. The problem is, David didn't read the instructions. The writer of the book of Hebrews invites us to come before God with confidence and faith through Jesus Christ. But he warns of the fearful prospect of judgment if we presume on God's mercy. And he concludes, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And that could be a really fitting epitaph for Uzziah's tombstone. But thankfully, that's not the end of the story. 3 months later, David's anger has cooled, and someone tells him that the house of Obed-Edom, where the ark has been left, is being greatly blessed. So David went up again to bring the ark back to Jerusalem. However, this time, things went differently. This time, David did find out how God wanted his ark moved. This time, David read the instructions. The text says, and when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. This time the ark was carried by the priest, as the law of God had prescribed. And there, in this strange reverence by which every 6 paces there were sacrifices offered to the Lord, things were done right this time. But it's not all reverence and awe. It's not only stuffy decorum that marks the ark's journey to Jerusalem. There's also King David, leaping and dancing with all his might. It's an exuberance which, at least in the eyes of his wife Michal, bordered on the obscene. Michal was King Saul's daughter, given to David in marriage of a political alliance. And this daughter of the royal court thought she knew how kings should conduct themselves in public. And it wasn't dancing in a skimpy ephod. Michal at least seems to think that David, in his exuberance, is uncovering far more than he should. And that's exactly what we like about David. Just as he shows his real humanity in his anger to God over the Uzziah incident, he now shows his real humanity in shameless, joyful, reckless, exuberant worship. Here's a real human being as he gets all caught up in hand-clapping, foot-stomping, sweat-soaked worship. David doesn't care what anyone thinks. Perhaps we can get a closer illustration of this marvellous moment if we can imagine Prince Charles at some Pentecostal gathering, tie loosened, dancing and swaying, waving his arms in praise, sweating through his once neatly starched French-styled cuffs. Now, can you imagine that? That was what David was doing. We have to notice the paradox here. On the one hand, Uzzah just touches the ark and God strikes him down. On the other hand, David dances with total abandon and God seems to approve. The difference is, David never thought that he could control God, as Uzzah seemed to think. But neither was David too careful with God. When Uzzah died, David lost his temper with God. God had interrupted his parade, and David went home to sulk in anger. But David's anger with God didn't get him killed, as did Uzzah's casual grab for the ark. Eugene Peterson suggests that the difference is that David was alive to God in his anger, as he was in his praise. David didn't like what happened to Uzzah one bit, but at least he was treating God as God. Uzzah would never have got angry at God. He was far too proper and well-mannered. And besides, you don't get angry with God in a box. Uzzah solemnly marched along beside the box on the cart and got killed when he touched it. David danced like a whirling dervish, utterly abandoned himself to ecstatic worship and praise, and God seemed to love it. David didn't care what anyone thought, or saw for that matter, and God seemed to enjoy it as well. David wasn't doing his dignified duty, carrying out some solemn religious ceremony for the eyes of the crowd. David was responding, body and soul, to the living God, opening his soul to the life of God as it flowed through him and around him. Maybe David's uninhibited worship was ultimately more reverent than Uzzah's dignified march, and perhaps more reverent than our buttoned-up, stiff Sunday morning services. So what does that tell us? It tells us that worship is all about God and not about us. We, respectable and proper types, tend to look down our nose at the sweat-stoked holy rollers and their raucous worship. It's not seemly. It's not dignified. But we've just got God in a box, just like Uzzah, or Michal for that matter. We've got God all tied down to the restraints of our sense of decorum and our reasonable assumption. We certainly aren't going to get carried away in worship. Let everything be done decently in good order. That's our cardinal rule. Well, maybe that says more about us than about God. Maybe if we got carried away with God, we might forget ourselves and know what self-abandonment of worship really feels like. David got carried away with God. He danced before the ark, careless, reckless, daring, a heart filled with uninhibited praise. David's worship was that of a fully alive human being. Yes. Now, I'm not saying that we all have to turn our worship into a hand-clapping, dancing extravaganza. But I am saying that in worship, our hearts must be given over to the joyful, awe-filled praise of God, not to stum, straight-laced, self-aware sense of what is proper. Worship is all about God. It's not about us. And that's what David teaches us in his self-forgetful abandonment to joyful praise. Uzzah's mistake was not a lack of decorum, but a dangerous attempt to politely manage God. Well, God can take care of himself, and what delights him is the kind of self-forgetting, God-intoxicating worship of a dancing David. Uzzah and David, death and dancing. In the jarring contrast of this strange story, we discover the meaning of true worship. A worship in which we lose ourselves in the awesome love and holy majesty of the living God. And it doesn't matter whether the children are in or they're out, whether they're noisy or they're not, whether we've got people who don't know the choruses, whether we've got people who like to dance, whether we've got people who frown on the dance. It doesn't matter. Lose yourself in worship. It's you and God. It's not them around you. It's not how it should be done. It's not how it ought to be done. It's not everything decently and in order. It's worship to our living and glorious God. Amen.